So to start, can you please state your name, your current position, and your field of study?
My name is Don McGorman. My employer is the National Severe Storms Laboratory, which is in NOAA. My field of study is atmospheric electricity, particularly lightning and thunderstorms.
Very cool. So what first got you interested in science, and what got you specifically interested in lightning and storms?
Well, I've always been interested in science. I'm not sure when it began. From the time Sputnik in the 50s, I remember that. And even before that, I just enjoyed chemistry sets and all sorts of stuff. So I've always been interested in science. The reason I got into studying lightning and thunderstorms is in part because that was one of the options at Rice University, where I did my graduate work. But the idea of being able to map lightning was just really appealed to me. It was the very first system, or one of the very first systems, that was available for looking at where lightning occurs inside of clouds. We hadn't been able to do that before that. And here I was, as a new graduate student, with an opportunity to get this new sensor and find out new things about lightning and thunderstorms. And it was exciting to me. It still is exciting to me.
So this might be a weird question, but do you have a favorite lightning storm that you remember, or a favorite place to look at lightning?
No, there are several favorite places to look at lightning. I remember when we were in Florida for the trip field program in the 70s, late 70s, looking at lightning in the evening as it was occurring over the Gulf Stream, and the thunderstorms would form over the Gulf Stream and just have phenomenal lightning displays. I just loved watching that. But then when I was storm chasing much later, then we would sometimes approach a severe storm and the storm would just light up. I mean, it would be more like flickering, seeing separate flashes. It's just a spectacular display of lightning, and kind of like 4th of July, only even better, I think. So those experiences stick in my mind.
So the reason I ask is I went to a marine biology camp in the Florida Keys as a teenager, and to this day it's my favorite place that I've observed lightning, because it's the only place that I've seen it jump between clouds rather than going from the cloud to the ground.
Oh, that's pretty special. I don't remember having seen that myself.
So what's it like chasing storms?
It's a lot of boredom and a little bit of excitement. You spend a lot of time waiting. You get the forecast earlier in the day, and then you try to position yourselves kind of close to where you expect storms to be. And then it's a big rush to get there and to actually take your data. We launch balloons into storms. That's how we study the storms. Measure the electric field and measure particle types and things like that with this balloon-borne sensor, or sensors. It's a lot of preparation, getting the equipment ready, testing the equipment, making sure everything's working correctly, then loading it up, and then getting out to the storm. And it takes about 14 people to launch the particular balloon that we use for this, because it's about a 30-foot long balloon. Even folding it in half to get it in launch size, it still takes a bit to manage. And so we have to rush to this spot. We have to be there at least 10 minutes before we really want to launch into that location, and then we launch it, and all the while staying out of danger, of course.
Have there ever been any harrowing experiences?
There have been a few. Safety is a really big consideration in our chasing, but there are times when you find yourself in places that you didn't really want to be in, and you try to get yourself out of that situation as fast as you can.
Can you give me an example of what one of those looks like?
Well, one time we had to go through a storm to come out the other side because we were out of position and we didn't have a whole lot of options for getting to the other side of the storm. And so we did go through the storm just fine, but we came out right in front of what was the mesocyclone, which is the part of the storm that responds to tornadoes. And so we did go ahead and launch right there. It wasn't on top of us yet, but we were uncomfortably close. And then we quickly got out of the way. So it wasn't in danger. There was not a tornado at the time, but we didn't want to stay there very long.
So. To me, tornadoes seem like the scariest natural disaster, because it's not like a hurricane where you have some sort of projection of where it's going, mm-hmm. and it's not like an earthquake where it just happens. I feel like it's that combination of knowing that it's there but not knowing which direction that it's heading, and that to me is a little scary.
It can be a little scary. We actually do have a pretty good direction of the that it's heading. Mm-hmm. It can shift, of course, but within some parameters of a cone ahead of it, we do have a pretty good idea. So the object is just always to keep a pretty good escape route. And so we try very hard not to get into a position where you can only go in one direction from that place.
And is there something that's particularly challenging about what you do, or have you faced any challenges in your career as a whole?
There are a lot of challenges. Getting observations is by its nature very challenging. Doesn't make any difference what kind of observation you're trying to get. When we're getting lightning mapping, it's challenging just because the system, you have to keep it working, and there are some challenges involved in keeping the system working. There are challenges with processing the data, keeping it going. The early system that we used was a thunder recording, so we would record thunder at several different stations, and then from the thunder we trace the acoustic ray back through the atmosphere. In that case, you had to know the atmosphere fairly well to be able to trace back through the atmosphere, and there are always some uncertainties involved with that. But it was a good first chance of looking at where lightning was occurring. In more recent times, we have VHF systems. The onset of GPS timing means that we can synchronize stations accurately enough to actually use VHF mapping, where we receive the spirits, the radio noise that you hear from lightning. We see that at multiple stations, and then from the times that it arrives at different stations, we can figure out where inside of the storm that it occurred. Well, you have to sight your stations very accurately. You have to know the altitude of them very accurately. You have to keep tabs of that in real time. You have to know what the levels of noise are. All sorts of things you have to keep tabs of. And then it's a challenge processing the data afterwards, because it is a lot of data. We take, by some measures this wouldn't be a lot, but we take about a terabyte of data a year. And that, obviously we can't look at all of that. And so choosing what to look at and then actually processing the data. We do try to process all the data so we can have a baseline from which to start, but it's a lot of work.
So it seems like there's been a shift in how things are done since you've been in the field. What's been the most exciting change or development in how science is being done?
It's been a whole series of developments. When we were doing thunder mapping, thunder ranging, that in itself was a great development. As I said, that was why I got into the field. The next system that came along was a VHF mapper that was, it allowed us to see the process by which a flash developed, but it had a lot of limitations as to the amount of detail we could get out of it. And then when GPS mapping came along, GPS timing came along, then we started having these what are called lightning mapping arrays, and that opened up a whole new slew of things that we could look at. And that has really, there's been a huge amount of progress over the last 20 years or so since those systems became available. So what we know about lightning and thunderstorms now is just head and shoulders above what we knew about lightning and thunderstorms earlier, and their progress continue to be made. There are newer systems now where you can actually see down to meter scale and down to microsecond scale, whereas with the LMA, we could see down to maybe 10 meters or 100 meters, depending on where it was. And we could see maybe up to 12,000 of these in time, but we can only see a particular kind of pulse. Now you can see much more detail about how lightning flashes develop, and they're actually starting to get really good ideas about how lightning is initiated in a thunderstorm, which we couldn't really see before. We had ideas about it because we knew where in a storm flashes were being initiated, but actually seeing the process of initiation start and at least getting hints about that from the new data is really, really exciting. That's one of the things coming out of this present meeting, is some of those data.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have any predictions for where it's going to go from here and what it's going to be capable in the future?
Well, judging from the papers that were presented at this conference, I think that we're actually going to be able to see some of the, a lot of the details of the initiation process. There have been a few competing theories. There's one theory that particularly has been favored, and that probably is the one that's going to go forward. But still, even that theory, there are a lot of the details of it that we don't really understand right now, or at least there's some serious questions about it. And those, I think, we're going to be able to answer over the next 5 to 10 years. That's exciting, really exciting.
My background's more marine biology, so I haven't given a lot of thought into the process of lightning or thunder, but it's really interesting to hear that this is stuff that we're still working on.
Well, you know, one of the problems with lightning initiation is that we also had systems for mapping the electric fields in thunderstorms. That was also a great advance, by the way. And Dave Rust, who I worked with, was one of the leaders in that, and I joined the game a little bit later on and did some of that. But the electric fields that we measured in the side of thunderstorms weren't big enough to generate lightning by the, at least what was thought 20 years ago was needed to produce lightning. So there are a lot of ideas about how you get around that, but they're all constrained by what we know are kind of typical large electric fields inside of thunderstorms, and that is a puzzle. And so there are ideas of getting around it. Some involve having little precipitation particles, ice particles in the storm, perhaps help initiate because they have a form factor that increases electric field locally, and maybe that's enough to let the flash initiate. And that's really, I think, what's favored now. Some particles, some kind of precip particles or ice particles in the storm seem to be helping the process get started. It's a little bit more of a sequencing problem than we knew before. It takes some false starts before you actually get a lightning flash sometimes. But
so is it kind of like trying to start your car when it stalls a little and then you get it going?
It's kind of like priming the pump. You know, it's trying to prime the conditions to get enough going so that it'll just keep going. And so it's an interesting problem. It has been a challenging problem. But I think it's exciting that we're starting to, I think, get data to help support our ideas and push those ideas forward.
Sounds like you've worked on a lot of interesting stuff. Is there one thing in particular that's been the highlight of your career?
Oh, goodness. Highlight. One of the early highlights was finding out that most lightning flashes lower negative charge to ground. And in the early 80s, we began seeing that with some systems that were lightning mapping systems, that instead there are flashes that lower positive charge to ground instead of negative charge to ground. And what's more, some thunderstorms produce most of the cloud ground lightning that they produce are these flashes that lower positive charge to ground. And that was a ground changer in a lot of ways. Why does that happen? And so over the last 20, 30, 40 years, we've been working on that issue. Why does that happen? And there was a big fill program in around 2000, and we got some data that gave us some pretty important clues. Well, what happens in those situations is that the thunderstorm charge structure, the vertical charge structure of the storm, actually gets inverted. So where you had positive charge, you have negative charge, and vice versa. And so that produces these cloud ground flashes that lower positive charge to ground instead of negative. You can get in other situations too, but these storms that produce mostly positive cloud ground lightning instead of negative cloud ground lightning, we think at least most of those, if not all of those, are the situation where we have a different charge structure inside of the storm.
How common is that?
In some regions, it's pretty common. In the High Plains region, eastern Colorado, northwestern Kansas, southwestern Nebraska, it's very common there. It occurs sometimes in the central U.S. Once you get to the southeastern U.S., it almost never happens. And since a lot of early lightning research was done in Florida, they never really saw these things.
Does it look any different to an observer?
There was some thinking that the flashes didn't branch as much, and that's true of the return stroke, but it's not. When we have these high-speed cameras where they're looking at the detailed process of developing, they're branching like crazy. So that was an early thought that they differed in this way, and still to the eye sometimes you can distinguish it that way, but it's not very reliable identification.
And is there one message that you would like to give people, either about yourself as a scientist or science as a whole?
I've been really lucky in having a lot of great people to work with, and being given a lot of innovative instrumentation to work with. Almost all of the progress that we see, it takes insight, sure, it does take insight, that's important, knowledge and background, but it also is having new observational tools that make those make progress possible. And so that's one message I would give to scientists, is always looking out for the new opportunities, being excited by the new opportunities that come forward with advances in observational techniques. And that is, observations are really important. All of our science is based on observations. And theory is important. I enjoy modeling. I enjoy thunderstorm modeling, but it all needs to be driven by observations.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to talk to people today and just talk about some of the changes that have happened mm-hmm. in the different fields, whether it's over the past 5 years or the mm-hmm. past, you know, 5 decades, and to think about AGU doing this as a centennial project and what's going to happen, not even just in the next 100 years of science, but what's going to be possible in the next 10 years of science. It's really exciting.
Yeah, the rate of change has been astounding. My first time coming to AGU was in the late 70s. Okay, so I've been roughly 50 years. And we started out in the Jack Tar Hotel, and we went to the Jack Tar plus the Cathedral Hill Hotel, and then the Civic Center, and then the Conference Center is called, in Moscone. So AGU itself has grown from a group that could be contained in one hotel that had one really large room and several medium-sized rooms, to 26,000 people that take blocks of meeting room space to meet. And I think that's an indication of the growth of our capabilities, computational abilities, observational capabilities. All kinds of things have led to explosion of what science is able to do now. And I see that continuing. I don't see that slowing down. Our models now are able to do things that were unthinkable even 10 to 20 years ago. Computer speeds, our knowledge, the background for our built into the models is just head and shoulders above what we could do before. And I think that's true of almost every field, but it's certainly true in atmospheric sciences. We have a model now that can actually produce electrification, produce realistic lightning, and I see that continuing forward. I think one day we'll actually be able to predict that, not exactly where a flash is going to hit, it's too random of a process for that stochastic process. But I think we'll be able to talk about pretty intelligently what kind of lightning and how much lightning a storm is going to be able to produce. We're already getting, making inroads into that. And I see maybe over the next 5 to 10 years actually being able to do that pretty well.
It's a really nice capability to have.
Yeah, would be.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add, or should we cover everything?
I think that's most of what I do want to call out Dave Rust. He was my mentor at the National Spear Swim Laboratory. Anyway, he is responsible for a lot of what we know about thunderstorm charge structures, and graciously allowed me to participate in some of that. So I owe a lot to him.
Those relationships are always so wonderful when you have somebody that really gives you those opportunities, makes an impact.
He died not too long ago.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Anyway, he was one of the giants in our field, I think. I was lucky to work with him. So he co-authored a book with me. That was a long and trying but very great experience.
difference in the process of writing a book now, and I'm getting to see the back end of how much work goes into it.
Yeah, yeah, we spent 10 years working on that book. So.
Wow.
It's about 20 years old now, so I'm thinking about revising it, but it was great.
It would be a beautiful project to do. Yeah. Maybe rededicate the new edition.
Exactly.
Is it okay if I shut this off?